Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. How much trust do you have in the mainstream media? If you're like me, then I'm guessing that you fully subscribe to that line that's going around the internet stating that however much you hate the mainstream media, it's not enough. I'm guessing you would agree with me that the mainstream media leans so far left that it's lying on its side. Progressives like to mock Fox News, or as they call it, faux news, for its supposed right-wing bias, but if you're like me, you think Fox News doesn't lean nearly far enough right to be considered right-wing. In contrast with almost every other mainstream media outlet, Fox News truly is fair and balanced. A Gallup poll released almost a year ago found that American trust in mass media ranks only just above the lowest that Gallup has ever recorded, which was in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election. The results show that only 7% of Americans have a great deal of trust and confidence in the media, with 38% saying they have none at all. Now, first of all, I suspect that those results have not changed at all, or certainly haven't improved since late last year. And secondly, I suspect the 7% of Americans who do have a great deal of trust in the media actually are the media. Because after the pandemic, after all the anti-Trump hoaxes, after all the political advocacy openly displayed in the media in the Trump era, it's hard to believe that any American with an IQ above room temperature has any trust in the corporate media at all. I bring this up because there's a new book out, a collection of essays about the media, edited by a friend of mine and today's guest at The Right Take, a book called Against the Corporate Media, 42 Ways the Press Hates You. It's an astonishing batch of insightful pieces by a whole slew of conservative critics, artists, pundits, and authors, a few of whom have been guests at The Right Take. They include Bill Whittle, Andrew Klavan, Kurt Schlichter, Mark Hemingway, and many others. I urge you to get this book. Even the editor of the book has been a guest on the show. I'm honored to say he's a friend of mine, a really brilliant guy with experience in the field of journalism going back a half a century. And I think he's just the right man to have a conversation with about the current state of the media landscape. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we are having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a true gentleman and a scholar. He was an award-winning classical music critic for Time magazine and foreign correspondent for them during the end of the Cold War. He's an award-winning screenwriter also, a political pundit and a culture critic, the author of something like nearly 20 books, I think, both fiction and nonfiction, one of which was a gangster novel that earned him an American Book Award. He was actually one of my very first guests on The Right Take. Michael Walsh, welcome back to The Right Take Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be back on with you.
Very glad to have you on. Let's just jump right in to discussing this extraordinary collection of essays that you've edited by an extraordinary bunch of authors and commentators called Against the Corporate Media. I mean, there's really no stone unturned in this book in terms of addressing issues with the corporate media. Tell us a little bit about putting this book together, maybe why you chose the contributors that you did and how you organized it, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, this book is the second in a series of what we hope will be a continuing series of books that will begin with the word against. As I noted in the first book, which was called Against the Great Reset, there's a long tradition of fulminatory jeremiads against various people and topics, going all the way back to the Philippics of Cicero against Mark Antony in the Roman Senate, and even before him to ancient Greece. And one of the early church fathers, Tertullian, issued a whole series of books against Marcion. Marcion was another rival early church father. So it's a tradition that we're proud to be part of. And we took on Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum in our first book. And we don't like to brag or anything, but about a year after that book came out, Klaus Schwab stepped down as the head of the World Economic Forum. So we're happy to take whatever small credit for that that we can. But our second book was always going to be the media. And we felt that coming out right about now, on the eve of the national presidential election, that it would be as good a time as any to spotlight the malfeasance of the media, not just today, but over the past, certainly, quarter of a century. As a result, I began to draw up lists of topics that I thought we'd need to cover. I went for a bigger cross-section of themes in this book. The Great Reset book was basically 450 pages of homework. It was 8,000 to 10,000 word essays, each essay, by various prominent people, including the late Angelo Codevilla, in what turned out to be his last major piece before his untimely death, and Conrad Black and Douglas Murray, and one might say the usual suspects at a very high level of usual suspectness. This book, I wanted to go wider and shorter so that it's a book you can pick up and put down and read around in, although it is organized thematically. And as a result, I went out to a wide net of people that I thought would be right for the subject, and then commissioned them, and then herded 40 other cats, and here we are. Tomorrow is Pub Day, September 10th.
Well, it's just an amazing collection. At the risk of asking you a sort of which child is your favorite kind of question, is there maybe one or two pieces in this collection you'd like to mention that you think are especially profound or important, or that you just want to highlight?
Well, not really. Again, I did organize it thematically. I used my novelist's hat to construct something that would have a dramatic rise and fall to it, and climax on a high note, which is why I selected them in the order that I eventually did. For example, we open with a piece by my friend Lance Morrow, who was my colleague at Time Magazine for many years, and he did a book last year or earlier this year called The Noise of Typewriters. So I excerpted about 1,000 words from that to set the stage of what it was like to be an old-time journalist. I myself entered the business professionally in February of 1972, at a time we were still using typewriters, and the newspapers were still being printed, and linotype machines were still using them to set the type, being used to set the type, and teletype machines were clanging, and editors were screaming, and it was this sort of chaotic, wonderful, every man for himself, but all working in the same direction entity that no longer exists. It's gone in the age of clicking keyboards and writing in near total silence. It's quite a bit different. So I started with that by Lance, and then I asked our mutual friend, I think Andrew Clavin, to write a letter to a young journalist advising him or her, basically, don't go into this profession. And that kind of sets the tone for the rest. But I think we have a lot of terribly important essays. We have two on the New York Times, which I believe is the sort of fons et origo of all evil in the country at the moment. Just about every position it takes is in opposition to the United States of America as founded. It's a a wholly owned subsidiary of Anti-America Incorporated, and it's a disgrace. So we have two pieces, one by J. Peter Zane and one by Ashley Rinsberg on the sins of the New York Times. We do a whole series of essays on how we got here. My own introductory essay talks about Walter Lippmann and his book, Public Opinion, from the 1920s, which explicitly advocated for a kind of top-down presentation of the news where journalists would be informed by experts and government people what the news was. And we now live in that world that Lippmann only could have dreamt of in the 1920s. A whole section is called The Media Versus America. And in each one of those, it's what the media doesn't know about something. I think it was the late Michael Crichton that talked about the Gell-Mann effect, which is that you read a story in the paper or online or whatever, however you read it, and it's on a subject you know a lot about, and you realize it's complete crap, that the journalist has no grasp of what this is. And as Crichton points out, he often confuses cause and effect in the sense that wet streets cause rain. It's basically that bad. And so the Gell-Mann effect then posits that you read everything else and say, oh, well, that's interesting. That must be true. So we know that the one thing we do know about is false. Therefore, the whole thing is highly suspect. So we got, for example, the media versus the military. Kurt Schlichter is writing on that one. We have the media versus guns. Elizabeth Scheldt is writing on that one. The media versus the cops. The pseudonymous Jack Dunphy, who is well known to many conservative readers, is writing about that. I also commissioned a number of non-Americans to write from Canada, from Ireland, from the UK, and from Australia. So we see it's not simply an American phenomenon. And another important essay in the book is by Priscilla Turner. It's called How Women Changed Journalism. And Priscilla is an excellent, excellent writer. She's married to Harry Stein, former lefty turned very much red-pilled righty. And I think she gets at one of the crucial turning points in journalism history, because journalism now is essentially a female occupation. And the reasons for that and the results thereof are really important and not discussed because it's politically incorrect to do so. And I wrapped up with the internet a couple of reminiscences by Glenn Reynolds, who, of course, runs Instapundit, and two of my former Breitbart colleagues, Hannah Giles, who was the girl in the Acorn videos, and Larry O'Connor, who is a WMAL Morning Drive talk show host in Washington. And we end with Bill Whittle talking about censorship, which is something that's very important right now as censorship becomes legitimized. So that's a sort of broad overview of the whole thing.
It's a great collection. I can't recommend it highly enough. Earlier you alluded to, you sort of anticipated my next question here. I was going to ask you about how you began your career as a journalist. I know you started out as a music critic, and then you suddenly found yourself working the crime beat, which really hooked you on journalism, apparently. What was it like? You kind of alluded to this already. What was it like in those days to get hired and work in an old school newsroom, and how has the internet changed that newsroom atmosphere?
Well, I started actually as a crime reporter. I had just graduated from the famous Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, one of the top two conservatories in the United States. And, of course, had no job and had written some practice reviews and had gotten a couple of stringer gigs to cover concerts that the main music critic of the paper couldn't get to. And then one day out of the blue, they just called me up and said, why don't you come in and talk about a job? So I did. But I didn't start as a music critic. I went basically right on the police beat, which was the best thing that could possibly have happened. And I'm going to dwell on this for a moment because it's so important. What you learn on the police beat is not only the techniques of how to write a inverted pyramid, who, what, when, where, how, why, et cetera, story, but you learn something about life, which coming out of a sheltered college environment, you don't know anything about. And one of the reasons I have a saying on the internet, I never take political advice from small children, is that I discount all of these young people, and now I mean people under 50, so that's where I'm at, who have really not experienced anything of life, and yet they're national pundits, mostly on... I'm about to go to Germany, so I'm thinking in German. Auf eigene Faust, we say in German, on their own fist or on their own toot, they've appointed themselves pundits. And now we see, you know, Twitter influencers who are literally 18 years old, who know absolutely nothing. But I would say until you've seen your first murder victim up close and personal, you really don't know what the hell you're talking about. And you have no sense of the reality of life or the finality of it and how quickly things can happen. So as a police reporter, I got wonderful, wonderful stories. Mafia murder, this huge fatal fire that burned down a factory, disappeared people. It just, all of the sort of sadness of life comes to you as a police reporter. In addition to which, you see all the police reports of the crimes from the previous whatever period, 12-hour period. They, in those days, they were collated and just written up, and the police reporter got a copy of each one. And you begin to realize that not everybody and not all cultures are the same, and they don't react similarly to certain circumstances. And it disabuses you of your sort of purist leftist notion of the brotherhood of man, let me put it that way. So that was really the best thing that could have happened to me, and I did that. I covered the local federal court on a big drug trial, which was tons of fun. You met an interesting sort of Mehmetian cast of characters while you were covering that. You know, and I was like 23 years old. And then my music critic predecessor quit suddenly, and I took that job, and I continued in that field throughout Rochester to San Francisco, the Examiner and the Hearst newspaper there, and to Time Magazine when Time Magazine came calling. But learning those journalistic skills is super important. For example, in San Francisco, I was there between 1977 and 81, and among the things that happened was the murders of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, and the riot that accompanied what was effectively a slap on the wrist semi-acquittal of Dan White. And I was very glad that I'd had that experience because I was covering a concert across from City Hall on Van Ness Avenue there, the big boulevard that runs right through the middle of town, and suddenly found myself in a complete bloody riot. And having been used to that as a police reporter and dealing with crime, I just waded right into it. I just thought, well, what the hell? I'm a reporter. I'm neutral. They're not going to conk me on the head. But police cars were overturned. They were on fire. Mostly gay men were up against a wall of cops, but windows were broken everywhere. It was just a scene out of Hieronymus Bosch. But it was that grounding in the police beat as a young man that really made me able to cover that story like anybody else.
In those old days, the press generally strove pretty hard to adhere to, or at least pay lip service to, standards of objectivity and neutrality, and we all now know that those standards have just been replaced by open advocacy and activism. When do you think that shift began to happen? Because it seemed like a fairly overnight radical transformation.
It was. It was Jim Rutenberg of the New York Times who wrote a piece during the first Trump campaign that Trump was not a normal candidate, and therefore he should be accorded no respect whatsoever, that there was not two sides to this story, and any reporter who had to do a, on the one hand, on the other hand, was being false to his craft. Now, this is still going on. I saw my old colleague, Richard Stengel, who worked with me at Time and then later served in the Clinton White House, of course, again, saying on Twitter just today, there are not two sides to the story. There's only one, and a legitimate journalist should only report the one side, because the other side is full of lies and disinformation and it's complete crap, and you shouldn't fall for it. So that's when it happened. So we can pinpoint it, 2016. And now the gloves are off.
Yeah, there's a Gallup poll, fairly recent, which revealed that only 7% of the respondents had complete trust in the media. So we know things are bad, but do you think things are going to get worse in terms of media bias before they get better, if indeed they are going to get better?
Yeah, because the media, the corporate media, you know, and by that I mean the big institutional media, has been wholly seized by the left. So it's bled half of its audience away long since. But the Gell-Mann effect then starts to kick in even among left-leaning readers. And I don't know how many times I've encountered New York Times people, readers rather, who were stunned, just devastated to find out that Biden was a rutabaga all along, that they'd been lied to, that this veggie had been president of the United States, because he was the sharpest Joe Biden, the on it Joe Biden, he could do the job standing on his head, Joe Biden. And then the next day, boom, he's a meatball. And they were stunned. They were stunned because they had no idea this was coming. But like, you know, good sheep, they went, yes, sir, we approve of the current thing. And the current thing is a woman who was despised 5 minutes earlier. Suddenly, the apostle of joy, what a bunch of crap that campaign has turned out to be. But you see the problem. They're going to just keep bleeding. Not everyone is a moron. And they're going to keep bleeding their readers until no one believes a word they say. You just can't believe a word they say because they have an agenda and they don't care who knows it now and they boast about it.
And do you think that's what it's going to take to root out this social justice agenda from journalism schools and the mainstream media and get journalism back to at least some semblance of objectivity and neutrality? Is just people eventually wising up?
Well, I don't think there's going to be journalism, Mark. I think it's a dead profession. I think the internet has killed lots of things. It's killed Hollywood, for example. It's killed newspapers, for sure. It killed the weekly news magazines. It's a great leveler. And I think what you'll eventually find is people get their news from X. I mean, Musk is smarter than everybody else, let's face it. And he knew that was the whole point of X, was to deliver news literally instantaneously to billions of people around the world. And that is actually Breitbart's dream come true. Now, Andrew didn't live to see that. And he and I had disagreements about the qualifications of citizen journalism versus real journalists who had actually done the job. But I'm a dinosaur, and when my generation dies out, you're not going to have any of those people with that institutional memory. And I think what you'll get is just this atomized view of the world, and you can believe what you choose to believe. It's very dangerous, but I think it's the only way. It's the only thing that can happen.
Well, again, you completely anticipated a question of mine because I was going to get to that question. What is the future of journalism? And you just basically answered that. You think readers are going to just seek out independent journalists like, Michael Schellenberger, for example, or a Glenn Greenwald, and follow people like that, and the corporate media will just kind of collapse?
Well, I think the corporate media has collapsed in the sense that it's really only the New York Times that's left in the United States. There's no newspaper that has any kind of heft or gravitas or pretension to covering a multitude of subjects. And let's not kid ourselves. There's a reason for that. The Times is, and always has been, in many ways, an absolutely excellent newspaper. It's the gold standard. Everyone aspired to work for the Times, certainly did in my day. It will stay. You know, it colors because of its current editorship and its ownership. It colors everything with its noxious viewpoint. But that may change over time. There may be a market for something that is more neutral than the Times, but as comprehensive. Or there may not. I don't know. But I can't see the Washington Post surviving. It's just ridiculous. And the LA Times is a joke. And there are no other newspapers effectively. So that's where we're at on that subject.
You brought up the late, great Andrew Breitbart a couple of times. And there is a chapter or an essay in your new book about the influence on the media of Andrew. He literally began my career as a culture critic. And you were the editor of his early website, Big Journalism. How did Andrew change the game for conservatives in the media?
Well, I think he showed the way forward. I think, like Moses, he didn't get to the promised land. Obviously, his life was cut short by heart disease. So the structure of the Breitbart sites changed radically after Andrew's death, and there were no more separate sites. They were all folded into one, which is the way they are now. Now, that had been his goal. His goal had been to sort of create an online newspaper with subsections, with something for every taste. So he didn't quite get there. He did understand the nature of the enemy, though, as you know, and he had a clownish personality that he could turn on and off, obviously, at will. It wasn't the real Andrew Breitbart, but he was entertaining on television, and he'd do goofy things, and he wasn't afraid to get in people's faces. In fact, the day that he took over Anthony Weiner's press conference, I was on the phone with him. And he said, "There's nobody here. What should I do?" And I said, "Why don't you just go up to the microphone and start talking?" And that's what he did. So he had that kind of chutzpah. But as again, he died too young, and he's irreplaceable. So that's basically what I have to say about that.
Bringing things back up to the present again, what effect is the media, the mainstream, the corporate media having on this current election cycle? I mean, we already know that they are in the tank for Kamala Harris, so they're circling the wagons around her. And meanwhile, they're trying to damage the Trump campaign with narratives like J.D. Vance is weird and Trump is a threat to democracy. Excuse me. Do you think these kinds of narratives are still effective and will impact the election, or if people wised up enough about the media too much to accept these kinds of narratives?
I think we've hit the point where the media doesn't matter, frankly. There are people who still get the news watching television. There's at least 42 of them that watch CNN apparently every night. I don't know why, but they do. But we're at a 50-50 country. It's not that Trump is ahead of Kamala or losing to Kamala. Kamala is a placeholder. She's the generic, not Trump Democrat. That's it. So it doesn't matter what she thinks. It doesn't matter what her policies are. And the Democrats clearly don't care because they're not going to tell you because everybody knows. But basically, it's going to be an election. It's really kind of horrible to have to say this, but it's going to come down to who cheats the most in Pennsylvania. That's it. The rest of the country should just stay the hell home because it doesn't matter. Our elections don't, as long as they're not safe, as long as they're not secure, they don't matter. So all that's going to matter is those swing states. And of those swing states, the only one that's going to matter is Pennsylvania. And God help the United States of America.
Let's talk about the First Amendment for a moment, because you mentioned it. You brought it up earlier in terms of censorship. Since we have a corporate media now that is more concerned or claims to be more concerned about the spread of misinformation and disinformation than they are about our First Amendment rights, what do you think the status of the First Amendment is going to be in the near future here? Is it seriously under threat, especially because we have a media that is in the tank for the regime, this totalitarian left-wing regime?
Yeah, it is. David Horowitz has said one very wise thing, which is inside every leftist, there's a totalitarian screaming to get out. And as you know, Mark, but our audience maybe doesn't, I spent a good deal of time in the Soviet Union and in East Germany in particular during the end of the Cold War, from 85 right to the end in 91. So I've seen this movie up close and personal, and it is personal to me to see that same aura and that same ministry of fear taking over the Western democracies. But they, in fact, disinformation is a Soviet term, so it's that's where that word came from. And all that means is you're feeding someone a plausible story that is not true. It's a cover story. It's a, in the spy sense, a cover story. It's a legend. That's what disinformation is. Misinformation is just, I could say, you know, it's raining here in Ireland right now, which would be a lie because amazingly, it isn't raining here in Ireland right now for the first time in ages. But that's just plain I was misinformed. I thought it was raining, but it's, now that I look out the window, I see it's not. But this has all been lumped together now and used as a weapon against the free exchange of information. And we're very lucky in having Musk turn out to have been red-pilled so strongly. And I think these countries that Britain is one, Ireland is one, that have hate speech laws or that have draconian hate speech laws being proposed. Brazil is a good example of a country that's completely out of control. I think they may have bitten off more than they can chew with Musk, because he has ways. He is now a supranational figure. As he pointed out, you know, once he gets another one of his Earthlink satellites or Skylink, whatever it's called, up in the sky, then there's not a damn thing anybody can do about it, unless they shoot it down, which they're not going to be able to do. And he said they can just shake their fist at the sky. If he keeps the free information flowing, then he will have done a real service to the world.
What can the average person do in terms of cutting through all of the media nonsense and the disinformation and misinformation and these silly narratives like the Democrats are the party of joy or they're the party of 21st century masculinity, that sort of thing? What can the average person do to cut through all that, get to the truth, and be just in general better informed about the state of the culture?
That's an impossible question to answer, because I don't have a good answer for it. I think the answer is nothing. That's what I think. I think we're moving into a world in which nothing matters. In which everything is subject to, that's your opinion, or that's your interpretation, or I think the rise of AI, I'm glad I won't be around for much of it, is horrible. We've always, as a historian myself and as a novelist, I understand the difference between making stuff up and basing stuff on real things and making it sound plausible and actually writing straightforward history. But when you lose the reliance on your sources, which you will going forward, because you don't know what any of this, how true any of this is. The AI pictures are obviously fake now, but they won't be. I know scholars from the World War II period who are very suspicious of documents, very authentic-looking documents, but that were faked, even back in the 40s. So you don't know who's planted seeds for you to mislead you. Now you have an entire industry of the world that is phantasmagorical. So I don't know that people are going to be able to. I think we're going to get very much more tribal, frankly. And the left is pushing the opposite naturally. They want everybody to be absolutely the same, even though people, as you learn on the police beat when you're a young man, they are not the same. And that cultural reactions change. And you can't substitute one human being for another human being as if they were a widget. You can't do it. They want to, and they're trying to force us to, but you can't.
Okay, well, this the new book, Against the Corporate Media, that's the newest one. You'd previously mentioned your first collection of essays entitled Against the Reset. What do you know what the third one is going to be, or the next one, let's say?
Well, I don't. I can't say yet because it's not final, but I'll let you know the minute I know that it's a go project, because it's another big one about a very, very meaningful subject, but I'll have to hold that off for now.
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to it. Michael, please tell people the best way to keep up with what you're doing. Are you much of a social media guy?
Well, I'm back on Twitter, which is nice. My handle on Twitter is at the amanuensis, that's meaning someone who is a scribe for someone else. So that's the way to do it. I'll be launching a Substack column here pretty soon as we transition our website, thepipeline.org, into a Substack column rather than a standalone website. But that'll be happening over the next few months. Right now, I've got another major historical work coming out in January, which is called A Rage to Conquer. It's a sequel to my book, Last Stands, from 2.5 years ago. So it's a military history.
Oh, I love that one.
Thank you. It's a military history from the Greeks at the Trojan War to World War II. But it focuses on specific body of commanders and the masterpiece battle by each one of those, and what that tells us about the nature of war and about these shared characteristics of generals that make them successful. So can I discuss this a bit with you? I'd love to.
Oh, please do. I'm very interested in this.
Well, for example, I start with Achilles at Troy. Now you could say, well, Achilles is a fictional character from the Trojan War, from the Iliad, but yes and no is the answer. But the majesty of that poem, which is just about contemporaneous, by the way, with the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures, is so foundational to Western society and what he did and how he reacted under pressure. This sets the template for everything that comes afterward. And what comes afterward for me was Alexander the Great at Gaugamela, where he defeated the Persians for the third and last time. Julius Caesar at the Battle of Alesia, where he was doubly outnumbered and surrounded by the Gauls, the Celts, and won. Constantine at the Milvian Bridge when he defeated a rival Western Roman Emperor, and then that leads to the Christianization of the empire. What's his name? Aetius, who was the last of the great Roman legion commanders who held off Attila the Hun in the late 5th century, just before the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Napoleon a figure called Bohemond of Taranto, who was one of the commanders during the First Crusade, the successful one, and who won the Battle of Dorylaeum and Antioch for the Crusaders. And what I note, and of course, Napoleon and Patton and Nimitz and Blackjack Pershing, what I noticed about many of these is that they all had a kinetic sense of the battlefield that's almost like watching a great pianist play or an artist work without thinking about it, which is that Alexander and Napoleon could both tell you where the enemy was going to be 10 minutes from now. They always knew. And so they went right at his heart, and you just could not stop them. So that when you go back to the Battle of Gaugamela, you look again at Austerlitz and you see it's the same battle. That Napoleon has gone to school on Alexander, which he did. He set up his forces exactly right. He went over the terrain, which Alexander had done too. And he knew what they'd do if he offered a dangle. Alexander always offered a dangle and let the left side of his line get the bejesus pounded out of it so he could come slashing across the battlefield from the right at the heart of the enemy and break through. And it worked every single time. And Napoleon modifies that, for example, at Austerlitz. So watching all these men react to the same sets of circumstances and in many of the same ways and with the same degree of success, it's quite illuminating. This has a lot to say about masculinity and human nature. In fact, both Last Stands and Rage to Conquer are books about masculinity.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the reasons I'm so interested in them. I loved Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. So I'm very happy to hear that you've got a kind of a follow-up to that. Looking forward to that. I'll definitely have you back on when that's out, and you can talk at length about that. So that's
that'll great. Be out at the end of January. It'll be, I think, January 29th or something like that is the pub date.
Good to know. Michael Walsh, thanks so much for coming to The Right Take. Listeners, keep up with Michael and do not neglect to get a copy of Against the Corporate Media. And thanks, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you can keep up with all the important conversations we are having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.